My best friend when I was 17 was a girl called Andrea Wolf. In 1998, she was shot as a Kurdish terrorist. My first film. This is me.
What's wrong from
she's running. This is Andrea. It's impossible to reconstruct the story of the film. Only the fighting scenes were shot, showing a gang of three girls trying to clumsily beat up any male they can get their hands on. The film is silent because the only spools we could steal had no sound. And Andrea was its charismatic, strong and beautiful center. The last time I have seen Andrea was 2 years before she went underground, 5 years before she was executed in Kurdistan.
They took her prison. One could hear her voice. The voice of Comrade Ronay was full of fear. She screamed. First her voice fell silent, then the one of Comrade Dior. Then Comrade Ronay was killed.
There are strange coincidences with the material we shot almost 15 years earlier, back in Bavaria, where we grew up. In the film, we are constantly fighting, probably for justice, and the ethic code of the film is that only villains use weapons, and the good guys and girls use their bare hands for fighting. Only in this film it is I who gets shot, and Andrea survives. She picks up the weapon, executes the villain, and rides off into the sunset on a motorbike. Her body never came back. What came back instead was this poster. It says, Martaya Ronahi, taken prisoner by Turkish security forces as a fighter in the Free Women's Army Kurdistan and murdered. The fallen revolutionaries are immortal. I found this poster in a cinema, hanging next to the posters of sex films, just like another pinup. As a revolutionary means, pinups are nothing new. Technically reproduced pictures travel around the world and spread heroic postures.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence, the word and the act. Violence devours all it touches, its voracious appetite rarely fulfilled. Yet violence doesn't only destroy, it creates and molds as well. Let's examine closely then this dangerously evil creation, this new breed, encased and contained within the supple skin of women.
You're gonna still drive away, Buster!
When we were shooting this film, women had to look good and keep quiet. Female role models were rare. We picked them up at the movies, for example, in this incredibly tacky film. It deals with a bunch of large-breasted women terrorizing males. We copied those postures, creating pin-ups which hovered between pornography and severe dilettantism. The picture of the woman with the gun at first referred to a game, which also contained elements of seduction and submission. But as time passed, it also acquired another aspect. This is Andrea in Kurdistan. These pictures are no longer in Super 8 but in video. Images of armed struggle spread around the globe by satellite channels. This is a picture of Andrea in a camp in northern Iraq.
Ja, in Deutschland sind wir in der linken Teilgruppe und wir haben gemeinsam mit Genossinnen uns umgeschaut, in welchem Prozess auf der Welt wir teilnehmen können, um etwas zu lernen. Und andere Genossen sind auch schon hier, wir nehmen teilweise in der Verhandlung und auch an der Welt. Wir wollen im Prinzip in der Verteilung stehen und wollen. Hangi sayılarla öğrendiniz? Neredeki şeyler öğrendiniz diye düşündük. Ondan sonra Kürdistan'a gelmeye karar verdik. Buraya gelmek için bir buçuk yıl beklemek zorunda kaldık. Yaklaşık 3 aydan bir kol adı medya.
Almanya'nın I received a tape of this film made after Andrea's death by a Kurdish satellite TV station. When asking a friend to translate the Turkish voiceover for me, he started laughing when he saw its director. He said, "But he lives around the corner." This was when I realized that Kurdistan was not only there, but also here.
Das gesamte Kriegsgebiet Nordkurdistan ist ein weißer Fleck auf der Landkarte. Der Krieg hat in einem Vakuum stattgefunden, es gibt keine Zeugen. Und in dieser Situation ist alles möglich. Alles, was in deiner Seele wehtut, alles ist möglich. Alles Schlechte, was du dir da vorstellst, ist möglich. Und alles das ist auch passiert. Den Geruch von Krieg in all seinen Formen, den hatte ich von Anfang an in der Nase. Und das Tragen von Waffen, das ist ein absolutes Muss gewesen damals. Gefühlsmäßig war mir das Tragen von Waffen widerwärtiger. Weil mir natürlich immer im Hinterkopf präsent war, dass es keine Accessoires sind wie eine Filmkamera oder was weiß ich, sondern Waffen haben einen ganz bestimmten Zweck.
Bodhidharma Road from India to China. At the end of his trip, he reached the Shaolin Monastery, where he is said to have laid the foundations of the martial arts. The Lonely Wandering Fighter became an icon for the struggle of the oppressed against the privileged. Later on, films take over the duties of the wandering fighter and spread the pictures of the fight without weapons throughout the world. But not only the pictures of fighting heroes travel, but also the practice of martial arts itself. Andrea continued to practice the martial arts during her time in Kurdistan, where she taught them to the women fighters. Martial arts are carried around the world by wandering fighters, by occupation as well as liberation armies, by itinerant monks, military instructors, members of obscure secret societies, freedom fighters, and even situationist filmmakers.
Thank you.
Andrea herself became an unfamiliar kind of icon, a traveling image when she was proclaimed a martyr for the Kurdish cause. This is a demonstration in Germany shortly after Attila Öcalan, leader of the PKK, was taken prisoner.
Niederhalten. Es sind Foltereinheiten der türkischen Polizei, die in Bayern ausgebildet wurden.
First we picked up and processed traveling images, global icons of resistance. Then Andrea became herself a traveling image, wandering over the globe, an image passed on from hand to hand, copied and reproduced by printing presses, video recorders and the internet. But at the moment it seems impossible to universalize this kind of icon, as in times of left-wing internationalism, when the icons of famous internationalists occupied the fantasies of metropolitan youth. We are not any longer in the period of the October, described by Eisenstein, when the Cossacks decide to join the Russian proletarians and internationalist brotherhood during the Bolshevik Revolution. Now, we're in the period of November. In November, the former heroes become madmen and die in extra-legal execution somewhere on a dirty roadside, and hardly anyone takes a closer look.
Liebe Freundinnen und Freunde, vor 80 Jahren war hier eine große Menschenmenge. Und der 7. November endete mit der Ausrufung einer Räteregierung.
A few days after Andreas' death, a demonstration is held in commemoration of the Bavarian Soviet Republic.
Die Entscheidung ist gefallen. Bayern ist Räterepublik. Das werktätige Volk ist Herr seines Geschicks. Jegliche Ausbeutung und Unterdrückung muss nun ein Ende haben.
November is the time after October, a time when revolution seems to be over and peripheral struggles have become particular, localist, and almost impossible to communicate. In November, a new reactionary form of terror has taken over, which abruptly breaks with the tradition of October. 1.18 million rounds of ammunition BM-10. 118,000 rounds of explosive ammunition BM-31, 187 MTW tanks M113, 85 Leopard 1A1 tanks, 39 Wreckers M88, 10 folding bridges, 5 reconnaissance planes, 600 rubber dinghies, 100,000 bazookas. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, the weapons of the former National People's Army of the GDR are given to the Turkish Army.
Sprich, die alten Waffen der NVA, die wurden an die türkische Regierung verschenkt, dann direkt gegen kurdische Zivilbevölkerung eingesetzt wurden. Als ich nach Budan gekommen bin, habe ich die Gelegenheit, eine zerstörte Militärkaserne zu untersuchen. Das allererste, was wir da gefunden haben, waren Munitionskisten für Landminen, die aus der DDR gestammt haben. Die Dorfschützer, die waren alle mit deutschen Kalaschnikows ausgerüstet. Die Panzer, die man sehr oft durchs Fernglas beobachten konnte, waren deutsche BRT-Panzer. Das war für mich ein Akt der eindeutigen Parteiergreifung für die Türkei und ein Großteil meiner persönlichen Freunde sind immer kurdische Leute gewesen und ich hatte dazu natürlich einen Bezug.
A mixed zone is created, where the boundaries of war blur in indefinition. Andrea took up her fighting name Ronahi from a Kurdish girl who died after setting herself on fire in Mannheim in 1994 as a protest against restrictions imposed against the PKK in Germany.
Allein 47 Verletzte beklagt die Polizei nach den überaus militanten Ausschreitungen von mehreren tausend Kurden in der Augsburger Innenstadt und wie hier auf der Autobahn München-Stuttgart.
Alle Dinge, die erzählt werden, also egal von wem, egal wann, egal wo, diese Dinge sind auch nachweislich sehr oft einfach falsch.
Der Krieg im Irak reicht bis Berlin. 160.000 Türken leben hier, ein Drittel davon Kurden.
This is me as a Kurdish protester in a TV documentary. In fact, I went to this demonstration against the Iraq war as a camera person. Because the director knew about my film project, he suddenly took over the camera. He grabbed a flag, wrapped it around my neck, stuffed a torch in my hands and told me, "Now look sad and meditative. Look as if you were thinking about Andrea." When the film was broadcast, it turned out that only one picture of the demonstration had been used in the film, and it was this one.
Der Krieg gefährdet auch ihren Frieden, die Türkei und die Freiheit der Kurden im Nordirak.
There's the pose of the militant hero, but there's another pose which is much more problematic. And this is the pose of the sensitive, contained and understanding filmmaker who tells a personal story. But I don't understand anything, and this pose is much more hypocrite than even the crudest propaganda icon.
Es gibt in jedem Krieg das gleiche Prinzip, das Prinzip, dass die Wahrheit als erstes eintreten muss. Die Tatsache, dass der Krieg keine allgemeinen Probleme mit den Fehlern gemacht hat, ist bis heute nicht eingestellt.
Not only the Turkish army, but also the PKK has committed crimes against Kurds. They executed 111 teachers in the region. The party gave the order to kill dozens of dissidents. After his escape from Syria, Abdullah Öcalan fled to the house of Russian right-winger Vladimir Shirinovsky.
Du kannst davon ausgehen, dass alles, was geradlinig erzählt wird oder so erzählt wird, also dass diese Darstellungen keine Widersprüche zulassen, diese Dinge sind alle falsch. Das gilt natürlich auch von der Geschichte natürlich.
Ich bin
none of us found a way out of the labyrinth of traveling images. In November we are all part of the story, and not I am telling the story, but the story tells me.
Schnitt! Danke! Gestorben! Also Jungs, mal alles fertig für die Einstellung mit Billy.
Los, los, trödelt nicht so, die Kamera auf die andere Seite, ein bisschen Bewegung!
Bruce Lee's last film was released 5 years after his death. He plays a movie star who has staged his own shooting in front of a running camera in order to be declared dead and to go underground.
On action!
But the scenes used for Billy Lowe's fake funeral are documentary scenes of Bruce Lee's real funeral. Since then, many people think Lee's death was staged and that he's still alive and merely waiting for the right time to return to society.
Für die Öffentlichkeit sind sie tot. Aber dann wäre es auch möglich, dass sie einen anderen Mann haben.
In Andrea's case, this fantasy is not a Hong Kong martial arts film plot, but the official state position.
Vorher, nachher.
both the Turkish government and the German authorities entertain the fiction that Andrea is still alive and that her whereabouts are unknown. In this official state fiction, Andrea might have staged her own death, just like Bruce Lee. According to the German state, Andrea lives on, and maybe she will never die. In 1983, we made a feminist martial arts film, and Andrea Wolf was its glamorous star. Then, this amateur fiction film suddenly turned into a document. Now, some of these documents have turned back into fiction. And this fiction tells us only one truth. The truth is that only in fiction Andrea disappeared into the sunset. The truth is that only in fiction I have died for my ideas. Only in fiction have the women become stronger than men. Only in fiction were German weapons not used against the Kurdish population. Not even in fiction are the heroes innocent. And only in fiction does the good ultimately prevail.
Als wir Mitte der 70er Jahre angefangen haben, so Stadtgerille hier in der BRD oder in West-Berlin zu praktizieren, haben wir natürlich die Filme wie Schlacht um Algier zum Beispiel oder Der unsichtbare Aufstand aufmerksam uns angesehen. Erst als Filme oder als Zeitdokumente und später natürlich auch unter dem Aspekt, was man aus diesen Filmen lernen könnte. Das war so. Ein ganz wichtiger Film ist Costa Gavras Unsichtbarer Aufstand über eine Aktion der Tupamaros in Montevideo in Uruguay gewesen. Und in diesem Film gibt es verschiedene Szenen, die wir uns damals genau angeguckt haben. Zum Beispiel die Entführung, wo halt Costa Gavras darstellt, wie Danny Trione aus dem Haus kommt und dann von mehreren Autos eingekeilt wird und dann verschleppt wird, in einen Teppich eingerollt wird. Dieses Teppich einrollen hat es später auch in realen Fällen hier in der BRD gegeben. Es ist zum Beispiel in einem Fall in Österreich, wo ein Millionär mal entführt worden ist, eine Lösegeldgeschichte 1978. Der ist tatsächlich in einen Teppich eingerollt, transportiert worden, wo dann die Füße etwas raussehen. Es hat also auch gewisse Slapstick-Elemente. Und auch in dem Film von Costa Gavras ist eine Szene drin, wo jemand aus dem Teppich halb rausfällt. Also diese Methode ist auch nicht zu empfehlen eigentlich. Es gibt eine andere Szene in dem Film, die fanden wir sehr faszinierend damals. Es findet eine Abstimmung innerhalb der Gruppe statt. Ein Kader der Tupamaros fährt mit einem Überlandbus längere Zeit. Es steigen immer wieder Leute zu, sagen kurz ihre Meinung. Sie steigen dann wieder aus und drei, vier Stationen später steigt der nächste ein. Der macht sozusagen so eine Rundtour. Und so sind wir auf die Idee gekommen, diese Überlandbus-Szene auf der Linie 1, die Route Linie 1 der U-Bahn in West-Berlin, zu verlegen. Und das hat irgendwie nie geklappt. Entweder kamen die Leute zu spät, man hat sie noch hinter U-Bahn hinterherrennen sehen, oder sie sind zu spät ausgestiegen, sind im verkehrten Waggon eingestiegen. Das war also ein Fiasko. Die Geschichte hat eine kleine Pointe. Als es dann 20 Jahre später Kontakte zu Tupamaros gab, gab es einen Kontakt zu Mauricio Rosenkopf. Und der hat dann nochmal unterstrichen, dass der ganze Film nach seinen Angaben sehr realistisch, alles Tupamaro, echt gedreht worden ist. Und als er dann hörte, dass das bei uns nicht geklappt hatte mit der U-Bahn, mit dem Bus, hat er sich schlappgelacht, hat gesagt, das war das Einzige, was Costa Gavras frei erfunden hat.
There is one, because obviously that film is really, really, really short, and there's one other thing I'm going to show in a minute, which sort of proves Hito's points a million times over. But what I want to do, and it's Hito herself has obviously written about this film a lot, and she's she writes amazingly about film in general, so I don't really want to give a kind of attempt any sort of major interpretation or anything like that, but what I want to do is maybe pick up on a few themes in the film, and maybe we can have some kind of discussion. Obviously, it's a little bit formal, this situation with the stage and everything, but there's... Huh?
Sorry.
Yeah, it's not a criticism, it's an observation. But there's like a roving mic and stuff, but I just wanted to start off with a few quotes from Hito herself. About the film. She says, November is not a documentary about Andrea Wolf. It is not a film about the situation in Kurdistan. She says, this project tackles the question of what is nowadays called terrorism and used to be called internationalism once. In one of the essays that she writes about the film, she quotes Agamben, and it's the quote from him is, an age that has lost its gesture is for this reason obsessed by them. And I think this idea of November, the time that comes after, and also just watching it again for the manyth is not a word. I was thinking about this idea of gesture and actually the relationship between the martial arts, the hands that don't have weapons and the guns. And it really became much, much clearer to me this time round about those who are unarmed and those who are armed and what it means to be in possession of weapons and to think about things in terms of war, to have the image of war as the kind of major sort of image of what's happening. As a kind of footnote to and what happened to Andrea, 40 bodies in a cave in the region which she was tortured and killed were found, I think, in 2011. And it's so, in a sense, obviously her image lives on, but it is likely that her body has been found. Okay, and obviously November is a short political documentary film that owes something to Godard, Marker, etc. But I think one of its many strengths is that it's not self-reflexive in the way that we've perhaps become tired with or used to in that format of the documentary. Political documentary film, where directors reflecting on their own critical practice or modes of cultural production gesture vaguely towards there being something problematic with the illusion of unity in the cinematic object or so on, or reflect upon their own practice in a rather sort of introverted way. At the beginning of the film, Hito says of her first film, the martial arts film, the feminist martial arts film, she said, in the film, we were constantly fighting, probably for justice. And in my mind, that's really the most important line in the film, strangely. Although, obviously, then the one where she directly addresses the kind of the situation of the documentary filmmaker and the position that puts herself in and any political documentary filmmaker is probably the one that gets picked up on most when people write about the film. I'll just read the quote out again. There's the pose of the militant hero, but there's another pose which is much more problematic, and this is the pose of the sensitive, contained and understanding filmmaker who tells a personal story. But I don't understand anything, and this pose is much more hypocritical than even the crudest propaganda I've seen. Okay, in order to move on to like a particular idea of the image which Hito has written elsewhere about, I wanted to show something which really tracks and kind of confirms in a way what Hito says about the transition not only of the technology, so obviously part of the film is about the movement from Super 8 to video, to satellite dissemination, to DV, and then to the internet, which she mentions briefly. Obviously, it's in 2004. We did have the internet then, but it wasn't so great. But what I wanted to do is show a kind of afterlife of Andrea and also of Hito's ideas. And I'm going to play this. This is a martyr video, a kind of celebration. If you ever go to Iran and watch Iranian state TV, you'll see these kinds of things where you have a kind of roll call of names of people who've died and images of them with some kind of classical or sort of sentimental or melancholic music. And this is a video put up about Andrea as a martyr by four freedom fighters. And as it's on YouTube, unfortunately, an advert will pop up in a bit, so I'll have to close that down. But I want to play this. It's only 5 minutes long to start maybe thinking about the idea of the image and the kind of the afterlife of an image and of the idea of an icon.
Thank you.
Okay, so you can see that the image of Andrea on the motorbike that is in Hito's documentary that partly incorporates Hito's first film has itself been transplanted and moved on as a kind of travelling image, precisely as one of the sections in the film has it. And I want to read just a few lines from an essay that Hito wrote in 2009, which also relates very strongly to this and the circulation of images, the moving on of image. It's a very good essay called In Defense of the Poor Image. She says, "The poor image is a copy in motion. Its quality is bad, its resolution substandard. As it accelerates, it deteriorates. The poor image is a rag or a rip, an AVI or a JPEG, a lumpen proletarian in the class society of appearances, ranked and valued according to its resolution. The poor image tends towards abstraction. It is a visual idea in its very becoming." Okay, so this movement of images and the travelling of images that Hito talks about is also a reflection, and this, I think, is also what makes it a much better political documentary than many, because it's also about the movement of material objects and images as material objects and ideas as images, and the way in which they travel because of the collapse of certain kinds of political images. So after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the weapons of the GDR are given to the Turkish army. So after the collapse of a certain image of politics, the weapons remain and are ultimately deployed against the Kurds. The former socialist armies are dismantled but not their weapons, says one of the intertitles. Andrea is perhaps killed by a gun from the GDR. So in a sense, here and elsewhere, maybe the slogan of a certain older model of political documentary making has been replaced by a subtly different, a global movement of images and weapons that at the same time renders certain struggles unrepresented and unrecognised. The pedagogical internationalism that Andrea describes, and together with other comrades, we investigated those processes around the world that one could take part in to learn something, which is the quote that Andreas has on the video, is an older model in some ways. As Hito says, at the moment it seems impossible to universalise this kind of icon, the kind of icon that Andrea becomes. What we have instead, perhaps, is a model of a generic icon, such as Time's Person of the Year last year was the protester, right? As a kind of evacuated, generic individual. So just to finish, really, to return to this idea of November as the period after a certain kind of icon and image and politics is possible. November is when the former heroes are madmen. November is when Andrea is killed. I think one of the most difficult things about the film, or one of the most interesting things, just to go back to the idea of the untrustworthy nature of the political documentary filmmaker, is the idea, is the extent to which we cannot trust this film. How can we trust it? There's a kind of pall of distrust that hangs over this film and renders it kind of even more interesting, I think. She says at one point, well, one of the voices says, "Weapons are not accessories like a film camera." And we're left with the idea that it is, as she says, only in fiction that the good ultimately prevails. And I think, just to return to this idea of using one's hands as a filmmaker or as a martial artist rather than guns, that this is a kind of an asymmetry in war that is never going to work. And I think that's the kind of the melancholic conclusion of this film in some ways. And I don't really know also what to do with the footnote, although it is very, very interesting. So that's some thoughts. And I don't know, I guess I'm chairing my questions or comments. Am I very, what are you doing?
I can come and get out of the way.
Yeah, all right.
Or Jamie, capable young Jamie. Is this on?
Can I get off the stage?
Yeah, I think you can.
Okay.
Does anybody have any questions about the films we've just watched, or any of the points that Nina's raised? If not, then I can sort of start with one, probably. Some of the films that we watched last night, I don't know how many of you were here last night or something, but there was, and in fact, in the little salon that we had with Hartwood the night before, we were kind of talking quite a little bit about, I'd like to maybe talk about gesture again or something, yeah. A wee bit. I joked earlier that that was the only point that I had to make, but it maybe is, I don't know. We were talking about like the concept of distanciation within Brecht or something, like a distanced kind of like alienation from the gesture that you yourself are making. So both making a gesture and also looking at it. So being, I think that's quite. I don't know whether that relates in some way. It seems like the films that we saw last night had there were an awful lot of individual kind of gestures or speech acts that were being made. There's in the essay that you were talking about, there's a nice quote about gesture from Agamben, which I wondered if, I don't know how many people have heard, so I thought I'd read it out, it's quite good. Gesture is the name of this intersection between life and art, act and power, general and particular, text and execution. It is a moment of life subtracted from the context of individual biography, as well as the moment of art subtracted from the neutrality of aesthetics. It's pure praxis. Or this like a process of distancing yourself, this idea of gesture is to be both making a gesture but also being aware of it or reflecting on it and deliberately distancing yourself from it to make some kind of point. I wonder if that's something that you could talk about a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, the point I was taking about gesture from the film is that in a way, you know, because of this sort of periodization between October and November, that, you know, that all that's in a sense happening is that the gestures are being made, like the gestures that repeat certain kind of political modes and even certain modes of political filmmaking. You know, they circulate because in a way there's nothing else, right? So they have a life that goes on. You know, so the gestures, and I think, but this is, you know, I think people do incorporate this into the way they make films and, you know, perform, like last night's performance, in a way was a sort of, like many of those statements were kind of, you know, gestures, you know, that had the mode of a kind of political kind of assertion, but perhaps without the content. You know, like, you know, you cannot make assertoric claims if the situation isn't appropriate. I mean, you can, but they seem hollow. And I suppose it's like, when did those statements and these gestures, like, revivify or come back to life? It's got to be in a different kind of context. So it's interesting, like, why do gestures just keep proliferating? You know, why do we just keep making the same kind of revolutionary gestures or political statements?
It was almost like in the I don't know how many of you saw it, but in the performance last night, there was documentation of many events that were necessarily separated from the artists, both in time and location. They couldn't have been in these situations, but the gestures, by showing these situations again and then kind of enacting or talking, the gesture or the, it was almost enacting that your distance or separation from those things. Like you, yeah. Like there's the only way to talk about it is to talk about the fact that you're removed from it and that you couldn't be politically involved in it at the time, but to try and reflect on what politics you might gain from it by simply embodying it for a moment or something.
Yeah, and I think one of those things, like to come back to something we were talking about last night, is about the role of affect. I mean, like when Hito is in the march, the procession, and you know, another documentary filmmaker says, "Look sad, look meditative, look like you're thinking about Andrea," and it, you know, and it's an amazingly convincing image when she's walking down, and then she breaks it by smiling and laughing, you know, when we see it playing on her TV. You know, it's obviously the same reel of footage, and then her image becomes incorporated into a documentary about the protest, you know, and taken for a certain kind of truth. You know, and I think that it's that thing about the worry about affect is that it's too affecting, you know, it's too real, like, you know, how the problem is that staged scene with the candle is very affecting. You think that she is sad. It's hard not to believe her, you know, but then she breaks it. And I think, you know, in a way it's a useful sort of critique of political documentary making. You know, that you have to be critical of affect. you know, or had to address it in some way. You can't, you know, well, you can use it manipulatively. I mean, most political documentaries are incredibly manipulative, but...
Does anybody have any... There's a question at the back here. I'll run up and give it to you.
I can just talk loudly. You might as well use the microphone.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, the position of the filmmaker of Hito. I think it was just as interesting seeing the performance of Andrea in the film footage, where the bit of actual moving image that there was of her playing the revolutionary, being interviewed by, you know, I assume that was an undercover reporter at some point for a German news channel, and she was very much, you know, I don't know. You can read what you want into it, but that she had the same sort of smile, you know, throughout it, that about to break and just say, this is ridiculous, this isn't going to be shown in the way that explains my entire life, etc., etc. So it's not just the position of the filmmaker, but often because she was very aware that this image was going to be reprojected back into German society, she seemed aware herself how ridiculous her pose would be in that situation. I found that interesting as well.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder about that, but isn't there a generalised distrust of representation? I mean, yes, maybe more so in terms of how one is politically seen, you know, like maybe, you know, in an age of video and, you know, everyone recording everyone, maybe there is a sort of, like, sense of one's own ridiculousness, particularly if one is trying to make, you know, earnest-sounding political statements about, you know, internationalism, pedagogy and so on. And revolutionary struggle, but I don't know. I mean, in a way, I suppose what I was trying to say, and I think that this, you know, this is that again in that move from October to November is a certain model of internationalism. That's the thing that's gone. You know, that in a way, Andrea is I would say rather more stuck in that mode. You know, the idea of going to fight for a struggle in another country, which is not the one that you have a passport for. You know, I mean. You know, the bit about how hard it was for her to get there. I don't know. I mean, I didn't read Andrea in that way.
I mean, I guess I just mean that's exactly what I think the projection back to a different audience, that because she's in one mode of internationalism that she's probably aware of isn't contextualised for a standard German audience, that she knows that anything she's going to say about her beliefs and why she's there is not going to work for an audience... the audience viewing it.
Well, then maybe maybe the only thing you can do is look happy about what you're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, then that question of affect. Yeah, okay. Yeah, in that sense, I agree with that, because, you know, in a way, she seems happy and she believes what she's saying, I think, and maybe that's the only thing she can communicate reasonably to a jaded audience thinking, who the hell is this mad person? I mean, that's, you know, the idea of madness and. It is linked with the idea of terrorism when Hito talks about, you know, internationalism, you know, moving to something else. And of course, yeah, I mean, of course, Andrea ends up dead in a ditch somewhere and the story isn't really reported. You know, there is no equivalent internationalism of the story, of her death. It's just seen as isolated and, you know, some strange pathology of hers or whatever.
Someone else is probably going to put their hand up, but do you think that sort of sense of internationalism works, say, in Iran with the martyrs' videos, that is actually, there is a context in which that idea of, cross-border solidarity does work for certain causes, maybe the Kurdish cause or the Palestinian cause, that it can be contextualised in a way that it has been decontextualized in the West or in...
Yeah, I mean, just to go back to some other point though about this kind of the poverty of the image. I mean, it's really interesting on Iranian state TV because the videos of the martyrs are from the Iran-Iraq War, and they're the original videos that were made in the late 80s. And what they've done is they've just basically got them on repeat for like decades, and the images have sort of degenerated. So you get this kind of, like, you know, really impoverished image of, you know, half a million young men who died in in the 80s. And then sometimes it's kind of linked up with Palestine and other struggles. But it's, I don't know, I mean, I don't know what people think of the YouTube video. I mean, I really wanted to play them together because I think they make so much sense together, and then they really, you know, what Hito is saying about the image and the fact that Hito's own images get reincorporated incorporated into another kind of document.
As microphone bearer, can I ask a question now about this idea of repetition, which does occur in the YouTube video, particularly in two senses that seem very stark, is that the same image is faded into twice consecutively, which is an image of a presumably an older lady holding a poster of Andrew, but also there's another seemingly very striking image in there where it appears, and it's very fleeting, but it appears to be other martyrs through history kind of placed alongside the image of Andrew, and I wondered, you talk about the poorness of the image, but what, you know, talk maybe more about the repetition of the poor image.
Because obviously that effect, what's it called? I always forget. The effect that's used on those photos when you zoom in and out.
Oh, God. The dolly zoom or Ken Burns effect.
The Ken Burns effect. It is that, right? That's been used.
ITunes,
Before you start, I was going to suggest, do you want to sit with Barry on the stage? Because then everybody can see. I realise that.
Oh, yeah,
sorry. We can stand with you. Sit. Come in and out at different hours of the day.
The repetition, yes, I mean, the other image that's repeated in the YouTube video is the one of presumably of Andrea as a child reading a book, right? Yeah. And it's, you know, I mean, there's the question of, obviously, right, I assume that somebody went to Google, typed in Andrea Wolf, and just picked up all the images, and some of them at this point, you know, because this is a few years after Hito's film, would be the images of Hito, you know, from Hito's film, right? And it's just incorporated into this kind of, program and sort of rotated. And I don't know. I mean, obviously the repetition of the image of Andrea on the poster as a martyr is in the film repeatedly. But it's really interesting that Hito, in the first one, the Oshalan protest, the poster that she focuses in on the most is the one with the stick covering Andrea's face. So, of course, it is the repeated image, but it's the one that's slightly, cut. And, I mean, I think also Hito's interest in the children on the protests. I mean, that footage is, like, really, really amazing. Of those, you know, she's, like, two children she focuses on. The first one holding a poster of Andrea, and the second one at the Bavarian sort of meeting, you know, commemoration, celebration. The boy dancing around wearing the bird costume. I don't really know what to say about the repetition of images, other than I suppose it's interesting that the poor image doesn't degenerate in the same way that a photocopy used to, if you see what I mean, through repetition. I mean, it's like the image starts off poor, you know, let's say it's a JPEG that's been, you know, I don't know, that doesn't have great pixelation and especially on a large screen, which is why I wanted to see them on the big screen, because, you know, to really get that kind of lack of definition. The repetition of images does change, like, in those different media, and I don't know, what do you think?
I guess I'm wondering about, like you say, like, it's not like a physical image whereby it reduces in value or clarity, it sustains something, and through that sustains a sense of power or a sense of gesture or all of these things, and how that might link to, I don't know, maybe a parallel between the idea of the dissemination of the image and how many times it reoccurs, you know.
Okay.
I think, I'm trying to think about that, and there seems like there's two things in tension that I can't work out. One is that obviously that to be a poor image, it must have been evacuated of something, it's lost something, but I wonder what it is that it's been evacuated of, whether it's its context and through repetition it's able to circulate. but it, in its circulation, it loses some connection to, it's being recuperated in some way or something, perhaps, I'm not sure. But then on the other side of that, I'm kind of thinking about writing maybe like John Roberts or things like that, where he talks about copying without copying, and to repeat something is never just to repeat it, it's to reanimate it. So it seems like to be a poor image through repetition, it may have been evacuated or lost something, but on the other hand, you can make an argument that repetition in some way reanimates it. So I wonder what it is that's been lost, and I wonder what it is that's being, it's being reanimated too, and there may seem, you know, like as if it's been telling different stories, or I can't work that out, but I just thought it's more of a statement. But I think Evan, in his role as question asker for the festival, has a question.
I mean, this works, I do, but I mean, I think the poor image question is straying onto sort of an old Catholic debate about the status of evil. Is it simply an absence of good, or is it a distinct thing? And I think that's at stake when you talk about what is a poor image. Do we simply mean it doesn't have the full investment of the kind of production quality, certain levels of appearance, nice pixelation filters, etc., that constitute the look of a good Hollywood image, so to speak? Or is there something different? I would tend towards the latter. I think one of the things that's, you know, that's worth highlighting in Hito's comments that I think is incredibly powerful is the refusal to basically try to make images that look good, insofar as every time you do that, you reinforce a certain regime of appearance that declares that we can do it too, because you're actually not showing, oh, we can do it without Hollywood. You're saying that is the correct way to make things look, and we can do it from below. And as such, the most powerful aspect for me of her film is the music, which is cheap and shitty and incredible in that way. And it's sort of cheery and odd. However, this is all to contest something you're saying, you know, to quibble with it, which is, I don't think the specificity of the material capacity of the digital image remotely contests or differs from the version of political melancholy that marks the filmmakers that you're seeing this somewhat in distinction from. And the reason I would say that is not just because it's a sad film in certain ways. That's obviously a relatively broad category. It has to do with the way in which it segments off the moments of cheer or fun, which are basically set up either, so there's the V&A, right? She has, you know, can dialectics break bricks? Same thing, the film that she made with Andrea when they're younger, these sort of kinetic, funny, good moments. Those are then interspersed with the incredibly flat voice that takes on, again, this sort of, you know, distance magisterial one, rendering these huge statements, the kind of standard chiasmatic, Germany's in Kurdistan, Kurdistan's in Germany. I'm not mocking these, but the point is that the energy doesn't transfer between these. So she's yet again kind of standing again from the on-high position who only looks at dusk back at these. The music's a threat to that, but the music is held off as sort of tonally non-contagious.
I disagree with that last point. I think that, you know, I mean, actually, we should talk about the production and what you did to the soundtrack, because, okay, do you want to?
Well,
basically, I think the fact that the music, and which I agree with your, you know, your description of the music, the fact is, it basically almost entirely obscures her voice at certain points. I mean, I've watched this film loads of times, and even still, watching it again this morning, there are still bits I can't hear. I mean, I heard them a bit better here, and I think that's the point. You know, like I think the authorial, you know, the kind of the melancholic political documentary maker pose is undone deliberately by Hito in this film, because her voice is so low in the mix deliberately, and the music at certain points of fun or whatever you would want to call it, it almost disappears, and it does in fact disappear. And one of the reasons why I think this is done so very intentionally is there's a specific moment where the quote that everyone picks up on, the one I said, you know, the one about where she reflects upon the, you know, the militant hero, the posed militant hero, but the more problematic one is the sensitive, understanding filmmaker. That sentence where she says, and the pose is even more, she actually says hypocrite rather than hypocritical, than even the crudest propaganda. And it actually, like, the next voiceover, which is not named, cuts over there. So you cannot hear the end of her sentence saying that.
There's also the intertitles that would wait to
yeah.
near the song. So.
you want to say that Hito's film is not so very different from the films that I'm trying to differentiate it from, or the mode of political filmmaking?
I'm saying that the work of segmentation of the energy that we get in kind of, I mean, look, one of the references here is obviously is divorce films. That she, I agree, she's kind of fucking with them. in a great way. But it does the same work of basically you have a deeply energetic, you know, segments of scenes, battle scenes, kung fu, etc., and then you remain the sort of the moment of voice and reflection doesn't ever let itself choke up, basically. It doesn't let itself speed up or accelerate. It remains sort of constant.
But in a way,
this sort of sea of energetic.
But in a way, I would defend that. I mean, you know, the fact that she retains what you're calling a flat tone in the face of something, you know, which is the death of one of her best friends. I mean, you know, in a way that's, again, part of the strength. Because, look, you know, the narcissistic thing to do in this situation, if you were a documentary filmmaker, would be to make it all about you, right? And she could have done that with the footage, you know, from the first film. And, you know, made it about a relationship between her and Dre, but she doesn't. She makes it about the relationship between, you know, images and weapons, you know, and about, in a way, the struggles and the difficulties of representing those struggles in any definitive way. You know, Hito basically points out that she cannot take the position that Andrea took. You know, in the first film, it's, you know, the point that Hito said, like, only in fiction could I die for my ideals. You know, it's Andrea who doesn't. And I think that's more moving to me than any...
This isn't a condemnation of the film. It's simply, I guess, a question I want to pose generally of why is it so difficult for us? Why is that basically a recurrent tone that seemingly... That's the very question I want to ask. Is why is it so hard to work through that nexus without sliding back into a tone that, as you say, we're tired of? Even if we're undoing it, that's still the touch point. Right?
Okay, I agree with that. And I'd say, yeah, so many films, especially in this kind of grey zone between like political documentary in a more formal sense and like art political documentary, I agree that this tone, I mean, there's something about the tone which is omnipresent and very hard to break with. And at some point I want to make a political documentary in which I just squeal throughout and shriek and laugh and stuff, which would be utterly unwatchable. But yeah, exactly. And I wonder, is it because, you know, this again, this goes back to something about the performance last night, you know, is it about the, you know, something about the seriousness? Is it the Isle of Minerva position, you know, where we're always looking back and we feel that, you know, if it's, you know, we can't quite be in the struggle in the way that maybe we would want to, but we can't be, you know, we are somehow, you know, like our accessories is the film camera, it's not the gun. you know, is it that... Because of all of the serious nature of those questions, that tone kind of follows. I don't know. I agree with the point there.
A couple of questions here as well,
too. I just found it quite interesting, the discussion about quality of images and the different formats or medium or media that were being used, because I think that's quite resonant with the way this is playing out in the world today. I think it's undeniable that image is a central weapon of war and the opposition of war and of occupation and the resistance to occupation in the world right now. And I've you know, seen martyrs' posters and martyrs' necklaces in many countries around the world, and the video that you showed is very good because it kind of reminds people who haven't seen that sort of thing before that that is there to encourage people to continue to fight that struggle. It's there to get other people to become martyrs. It's not without purpose. It's to get you to give up your life in a struggle for a cause. In a battle of what is often referred to as asymmetric warfare, where you have the most powerful armies in the world, America, Britain, so forth, attacking developing countries, and people fight back with, you know, bombs strapped to their bodies because they don't have the firepower or the technology to meet face to face in the battlefield. The asymmetric warfare is essentially advanced technology militaries coming against people who are, you know, throwing themselves under the machinery of war to try to stop it or to try to defeat it. So I think the images that you see, you know, the American government is brilliant at using, and the British government, brilliant at using images to promote their causes in Iraq and Afghanistan. For example, how many times did we see the imagery of smart bombs going into Saddam Hussein's bunker, you know, with the tracking and in the night and all these kind of things, like showing how smart their weaponry is, and it's not actually killing anybody but the bad people, and so we should let them carry on, and all this sort of thing. And then you see the other side, which are the images of martyrs and the you know, low quality video footage that came out from Al Qaeda and this sort of thing. So I think the international is still there. Al Qaeda functions in that manner. It brings people from all around the world. George Bush said, if you want to fight America, come to Iraq. He invited people to come there and fight the American army. And obviously that came to be. So now Al Qaeda is in Iraq and America isn't, theoretically, on both sides of that equation. So I think the quality of images and the sources is quite resonant in the way it is actually playing out. And I think it is quite relevant, and it seems maybe a bit patchwork as a piece, but so is the reality of it as we see it.
Yeah, that's a great comment. Just a couple of things on that. It's interesting, like, just to reflect on the footnote in relation to what you're saying. I mean, you know, we know that before going into Iraq that, you know, the American politicians and you were going to do it would sit down and watch the Battle of Algiers and so on as well. And I think it's this double-edged thing about who uses those images. You know, it's, you know, you watch films of revolutionary struggle and it's maybe like a manual, albeit one that doesn't always work with the bus. You know, but it's also, you know, something, an educational tool for those who are fighting freedom fighters. I mean, you know, that you cannot separate it out in that way, you can't section it off. I mean, the other thing is, though, of course, when, damn it, I can't remember who the foreign secretary was at that point, but when, you know, I can't remember who it was either because my memory is shit, but where some American politicians went to discuss something, and there's the Guernica was in the building. Like, so people must know this, where this happened.
Colin Powell,
yeah, that's it, right? And they turned Guernica to the wall, you know, so that he wouldn't have to see it because this was, you know, at the time of the war. And I think, you know, so it's that kind of, you know, that about the powerful nature of images and the defense of the poor image as a powerful image is precisely, you know, what you're saying about the you know, the what function they're serving, you know, what function the martyr videos are for, yeah, which is something, you know, I should have suggested a bit more, but I mean, I'm very interested in this claim in the poor image essay that the poor image tends towards abstraction. I mean, in that sense, you know, like the abstraction of an idea, the abstraction of a cause, you know, to precisely convince people to break with their everyday life and to struggle.
Just a comment. I remember one image now when you're talking about this was the statue of Saddam Hussein coming down after he'd been captured. What you see after that, that was on the news, was that an American flag comes up on there, that he'd been told to pull this statue down, these Iraqis. And obviously that is such an image that justifies almost the war, because you could see the happiness of these men that this dictator had been taken away. But actually, they've been told to do this because they knew the importance of these images for the world. Another thing that's just I want to point out, that I've gone back to Iran in many close intervals. And when I go, I see, you know, go to the same street where my grandmother lived, and infrastructure is kind of the same, you know, streets look the same, hadn't still cleaned it up. But when I looked around, more and more artists has been commissioned to the artworks. So they're just not on TV, so these martyrs. So every time I look around, like, streets look the same, but on every building, there's always a new picture of a martyr. And it's really interesting, it's been brought up, because I've always thought, like, what's the point? This is how many years later, and they're still putting a picture up. And I talked to my mom, and we went to the street, and she said, well, he realized the name of the street that she's been raised and where my grandmother lives was not always called this. This was a boy name changed after a boy who died in the war on the street, and they named him this martyr, and they changed the name, the government changed him. And I said, oh, okay, so he's a martyr. And she said, no, he's a victim. For us, he's a victim. He didn't want to go to that war. But it was such loss of life in those wars. A million young men didn't want actually to die. So I think these images and these names they give everywhere, they change every big square, they've given a new name, and it's, I think it's a bit to give a purpose to these hopeless, like, you know, pointless lives that were wasted. Just a placard that says Ali Nejad, or what his name was.
Yeah, I mean, one thing just related to that, in Iran, I mean, you know, when you go to the cemeteries where the soldiers are buried, and, you know, they're all 16, 17, but one thing that's was very different from me, like, in comparison to sort of British cemeteries, was the use of the image of the face, you know, that so many of the graves had either a photograph if it was in a shrine, or a kind of drawing on the tombstone, you know, a kind of constant visual reminder of, you know, the individuality of this person, which is very different from the kind of cemeteries of the Allied dead that you go to, the mass cemeteries, which are, you know, a white cross or a Star of David or something like that. You know, and depending on the religion, and I don't know where I'm going with this, but I mean, you know, one of the things I always thought was very interesting in Tehran, where the British embassy is on Bobby Sands Street, you know, as a kind of recognition of you know, a different kind of struggle and a way of kind of turning protest against the British, which I thought was great.
We've maybe got time for one more question, and then we might have to wrap up.
Yeah.
People in Glasgow will know the story, but there's a square in the centre of Glasgow that's called Nelson Mandela Place, and it used to have the South African Embassy on it, and they changed the name for much the same reason, so that every letter was addressed to Nelson Mandela Place during the apartheid era. I was thinking about this idea of the poor image, and it's the poor image is sort of, it struck me as the image was of the sort of the local hero. It's kind of, it's the yearbook photo blown up to a full page spread, you know, tragic death, dies young sort of thing, and it's, you know, where you can see the grain of the image. It's that sort of degradation of the small, you know, unimportant image, then recontextualized, blown up into a very important image. But what was interesting about the film of Andrea was that, especially the YouTube one especially, is that all the images they'd obviously picked out were the ones, it wasn't so much that they were sort of her innocent as a young girl or a young woman. They were all in some way able to be put together into sort of the image of the sort of nascent revolutionary. That she, there she is reading a book. I don't think it was, you know, the 18th Brumaire, but it might as well have been. And then there was sort of every single image, and even the sort of the film stuff in the first film of the film that she was making. The music that they used to put over was from a Kurosawa film. I think it might have been like Seven Samurai, one of the battle sequences. So they kind of she'd chosen to make it into this, but not Hollywood bombastic film. It's sort of almost like the stereotypical non-Hollywood bombastic tradition. I found that interesting. So that's not a question, really. But this idea of it being the yearbook and the local hero, the martyr video, seemed very much to me wanting to kind of, turn her into that sort of figure.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose just to wrap up then, if we have to, I mean, just to go back to something that Evan said, which relates here, I mean, you know, this idea of not competing, you know, like the poor image, to celebrate the poor image, and to celebrate the poor sound, let's say, or the trashy sound, or whatever, you know, the kind of generic, like, you know, B-movie film music or something, you know, to not use CGI, to not use quality, you know, technology or whatever. I mean, how much of a I don't know, like, what is the strength of the poor image and the poor sound, I suppose? You know, to deliberately mix your voice low in the mix so that you know, that your points are kind of trail off, and is it in a way in sympathy with the poverty of those images of the icons who could no longer be our icons because it's November and it's not October? So maybe there's a kind of sense of solidarity or something between Nito and Andrea because of the, you know, what Andrea's image has become. And yeah, that'll do.
Okay.
Okay, well then, yeah, we've got to finish up now, so thanks very much everybody for coming. Oh, is Brad got an urgent point?
Well, no,
well, we've got like 1 minute, go on, say something.
I mean, it's not a great last point because I should have spoken up earlier, but I have major problems with this film. And partly I think it's to do with, I think with Hito's work, the most interesting part is the relationship between her films and her writing, and her writing is absolutely outstanding. And we've talked a lot about, drawn a little bit of that into this, but somehow with this work, I can't help thinking about where it falls short. And in a way, her writing supplements some of those issues for me. But I do sort of think about... she never really gets through to the idea about how we live fictions as if they're facts, for one thing. I mean, so she sort of talks in and around something, you know. And I always think, where am I as a viewer in a relationship to this kind of content that she's putting forward? I sort of struggle a little bit with where I'm being placed in relationship to some of the things that you're talking about, which I don't think are resolved by kind of material claims somehow. I sort of struggle myself to think about this tonality and this effect and these processes that we're raising, because it seems to me we're in a process of having to reinvent languages and processes in order to find a new way of speaking and thinking. And somewhere between her films and her writing, I think that is kind of being achieved. But if we just look at the film on its own, I'm not absolutely sure that it's there. I don't know if you feel that's a fair comment.
Yes, I suppose. But then I would always sort of caution against treating films as authoritative objects that are going to, you know, capture everything. I mean, I don't think it's a problem that... I mean, obviously, we're just looking at this film and some of her lines from her writing, but I wouldn't see it as so much of a problem if this film feels flawed or unresolved, and because I wouldn't see it in terms of how we're needing to supplement it with her writing or something like that. I see it as all part of...
I think it's reproducing many of the conditions that she's trying to critique, essentially. This is really difficult. This is why I almost didn't speak, because of
No. I mean, I do take your point. I mean, it's very well made. You know, you put it very well. But I mean, it's interesting that, like, when we asked Hito, well, when Barry asked Hito about how best to show the film, you know, that, like, in terms of projection and dimensionality and all of those things, she just said, "I don't care. It doesn't matter."
In so many words, yeah, for sure, yeah. And also that, in fact,
that when we got the film, we were like listening to it and thinking, God, the audience is never going to be able to hear this, and you think that might be, your impression might be that might be a mistake, but it is a very much a commitment. You know, we've tried to, as good professionals, we've tried to look at the sound and see how you can make it more legible, and if you make the voice more legible, then the music is completely overbearing, and there's nothing that you can do to the sound to make it palatable to an audience, you know, and this is a well-equipped, you know, space, so there's definitely, you know, this, there's like definitely a commitment to that.
Yeah. Like.
Okay, all right, so, well then, here we go, unless Brad has another question, then, thank you very much again, everybody, for coming. I'd very much like to invite you back into this space in half an hour for a presentation and a screen by Graeme Harwood. Thank you again.